serving Srinam of their wives, Bhagavati, for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, Sri Krishna, Bhaktim, pure devotion, Alaukikim, transcendental to this world, Atmanam, themselves, Cha, and Taya, of that, Heenam, devoid, Anutapta, lamenting, Vyagarhayan, they condemned. Translation, taking note of their wives, pure, transcendental devotion for Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and seeing their own lack of devotion, the Brahmanas felt most sorrowful and began to condemn themselves. Text 14. The Brahmanas said, "To hell with our threefold birth, our vow of celibacy, and our extensive learning. To hell with our aristocratic background and our expertise in the rituals of sacrifice. These are all condemned because we were inimical to the transcendental personality of Godhead." Purport, as explained in the definitions above, the words Trivrid Janma, or threefold birth, refer to 1. Physical birth, 2. Brahminical initiation, and 3. Initiation into the performance of Vedic sacrifice. Everything is useless if one is ignorant of the absolute truth, the Supreme Lord Krishna. Translation, taking note of their wives, pure transcendental devotion for Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and seeing their own lack of devotion, the Brahmanas felt most sorrowful and began to condemn themselves. They said, "To hell with our threefold birth, our vow of celibacy, and our extensive learning. To hell with our aristocratic background and our expertise in the rituals of sacrifice. These are all condemned because we were inimical to the transcendental personality of Godhead." So here we see a reformation of the Brahmanas. And inspiration for this is their wives. Their wives were devotees of the Lord, whereas they were not. And when they saw the example of their wives, then they understood the truth. This, of course, is not always the situation. A lot of people see devotees, whether it is wife or children or whatever, or husbands or whatever, and they're not sympathetic at all. In fact, they may be the opposite, and they may discourage their family members or whatever from devotional service. But it is good fortune here that we see the Brahmanas actually were inspired by the example of their wives. Now, of course, normally it is the responsibility of the husband to set a good example for the wife, and the wife simply follows the husband. And that's the normal procedure, since the husband is considered superior in the Vedic society in one sense. So the wife follows along after the husband obediently. Here we see that actually the wives became independent, which was remarkable because generally they don't break the orders of the husband, you know, they're obedient, but out of great attraction for Krishna, they did that, only because of great attraction for Krishna. So that was not a fault, because they had this great attraction for Krishna. And therefore they violated the order of their husbands. But after it was all over, somehow they forgave their wives and didn't mention it again, and rather they began to admire their wives. And they actually understood that to worship the Supreme Lord Krishna is the essence of all the Vedas. So in other words, they got some inspiration from this. Now, of course, it was not only on their own, but Krishna made some arrangements so that they would not be hostile to their wives. So we can say there's mercy of Krishna involved here. Anyway, it was their good fortune. They got the mercy of Krishna, and their good fortune that they could see the advancement of their wives and follow their example in this case rather than trying to be superior to their wives. So therefore they got very great advantage from this. So that we have normal rules to follow in Varnashram scripture, etc. All sorts of rules are there. We see also there are exceptions to the rules. So though the wife is usually obedient to the husband, here we see the opposite. The wives weren't obedient to their husbands, and then the husbands became inspired by that good example of their wives who were so attracted to the Lord and understood the essence of the Vedic scriptures. So here we see something opposite, and it is also praiseworthy. So in this way, the whole situation was resolved so that there was no problem in the family itself. And as well, the wives had their desires fulfilled because they got transcendental bodies with which they could, and in those bodies they could associate with Krishna. And at the same time, they satisfied their husbands by coming back. And at the same time, the brahmanas got advanced because they became devotees also. And they understood the nature of Vedic sacrifice and what was the actual purpose of the sacrifice. So everybody got benefit from this particular leela. So this is Krishna's great mercy and his expertise in satisfying everybody. Normally, of course, we'll see in the material world this may not take place. When one sees the particular activities and excellence of another person, instead of showing regret and repentance for one's own lack of those qualities, one may show envy, anusuya, and begin to hate the person. Instead, if they are devotees, and we see that in the material world, a lot of materialists become envious of the devotee, or the parents become envious of the children, or whatever, who become devotees, or whatever. So it is very good fortune here that the Brahmins didn't show such qualities, but rather they became very, very repentant for their own activity, and they understood that they were wrong, and that and their wives were actually correct. So this, we can say, is something of the mercy of the Supreme Lord. So then the Brahmanas spoke, and they say here, they talk about their trivrid janma, or threefold birth. And generally we understand the two births, dvija. One is born twice, that is, one is born from the womb of the mother, and then one is initiated into the Vedas with Upanayanam ceremony, and one has got a second birth. And then the person is called Dvija. The three upper castes, the Vaishyas, Kshatriyas, and Brahmanas, become Dvija. But often, because of all those three, the Brahmana is the most prominent. He is referred to as the Dvija. But actually, all three are Dvijas because they all get the second birth and are qualified to study the Vedas. Anyway, they have the second birth, which is not the physical birth, but another birth, we can say a spiritual birth, in which the mother is the Gayatri Mantra of the Vedas. But here we see there's a Trijanma, third birth. They are third born. So sometimes we have, for sacrifices, they also need a third purification rite. And that is called the third birth. So we have 1, 2, 3 births. So if one is third born, then he's more advanced than the regular Dvija. He's a Trija. A very specialized person. This is not so common, of course, nowadays in the Vedic world or in the Brahminical world. You don't see too many people with a third birth in the normal sense. However, it is interesting to note that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati has taken this example of third birth to indicate that if one becomes a Vaishnava, this is also a birth, so this is like the third birth. So we get the first birth, the second birth, and the third birth. In this way, Vaishnavism is considered some sort of birth also. And of course, what does birth mean? It means that one begins a new life. It says when you're born, you start a life which is different from the previous life in a different body. So we do not see a change of body with each of these births, that is the second or the third birth. We don't see a physical change of body. But there is a change in the sense that one gets different knowledge. And if one gets knowledge, then one can actually change life. The whole purpose of vidya is to remove avidya, and avidya is the cause of bondage in the material world. So if we get rid of material bondage, then we can change things. So with knowledge, we can destroy ignorance, and consequently we can destroy karma. And karma is what determines this life. So therefore, with each step in knowledge, we can begin to destroy karma. And therefore, we're different. Because the karmas become different. Originally, of course, they had the two births. And if one took Vedic knowledge, that was vidya. And by that, one gets knowledge and ultimately liberation. So then one gets out of the material world permanently by that. You destroy all your karmas and you get out of the material world. So the same example or analogy, if you can give it for the Vaishnava initiation. And with that initiation, again, one gets knowledge, and by that knowledge, one can transcend the material world. Now, what is the difference? Why do we need both of them, actually? Why do we need three births? Why not two births or whatever? So as I said, originally there was the Vedic one was the strong one. One took the Vedic initiation and studied the Vedas. However, we also know that as time goes on in the material world and Kali Yuga occurs, the Vedas are very difficult to understand, and therefore getting knowledge of the Vedas is not very practical for most people, even for the Brahmanas. So if you were to take all the Brahmanas in India today and have them recite the Vedas, maybe 2% couldn't recite anything from the Vedas out of all the Brahmanas. And they don't learn anything. They simply grow up, get their thread, and then go off and get married, and that's it, and take a job. And they don't get any Vedic knowledge, don't go to the Gurukul or anything. So that knowledge, of course, is how to apply that knowledge is very, very difficult. Firstly, they have to learn the knowledge by reciting the mantras daily, every day for 20 years or so, and learning the Vedas inside out. But then they have to apply it to sacrifice, and they have to sacrifice the rest of their life. But nowadays you cannot support yourself with sacrifice, so everybody goes out and gets jobs. that type of knowledge and its effect is very little in Kali Yuga. So the Shastras tell us that in Kali Yuga, what is the method of deliverance? So it is not through the Vedas and through the Upanayanam Samskar connected with the Vedas, rather it is through Pancharatrika initiation, Pancharatrika Diksha. So this will deliver us in Kali Yuga. So what is the difference? The difference is that one gets initiated with, not with Vedic mantra, but with Pancharatrika mantra. And what is the Vedic mantra for initiation? That, of course, is the Brahma Gayatri. And it's non-different from the Supreme Lord, etc. But it is a little indirect. So some people will take the Brahma Gayatri as worship of the sun. Savitra, Savita. Some people will take it as worship of Shiva. Some will take it worship of Brahma. Some take it worship of Vishnu. Some take it worship of impersonal Brahman. So it's got various meanings to it. Of course, Jiva Goswami has written, following the Agni Purana's explanation, he says, Brahma Gayatri is worship of Vishnu, actually. So it is. But it is a rather general indication because it doesn't mention Vishnu's name directly there. And as a Vedic mantra also. So what is the difference? The difference is that with Pancharatrika initiation, we get mantras, which may be similar to the Vedic mantras in some senses, but there is a direct expression of the Supreme Lord. So of Vishnu or Krishna or other avatar deities like Varaha or Kurma, whoever. So the mantras are very direct there. And what else? Because they're not Vedic mantras, they do not require the same qualification of being born in a certain family. So you do not have to be born in a Vaishya family, Kshatriya family, or Brahmin family to get the mantras. Anyone can take the Pancharatrik mantras. So that becomes open for everybody. So what is the qualification for Pancharatrik mantras? Faith. One may be a Brahmin, and one may not be a Brahmin, or Kshatriya, Vaishya, whatever. One can be anybody. If one has faith in the Supreme Lord, Vishnu or Krishna, then one can take the initiation. So a little more flexible in that way also. And of course, learning the verses, whatever you have to learn, is much easier. Because what is the learning of the Vedas? It is the Vedic mantras and the Upanishads, basically. And this is very difficult to understand. And they have a lot of controversy about what the meaning of everything is there. So instead of that, then we have Pancharatrik literature. There the meaning is very clear, just as the Puranas are an explanation of the Vedas for the people of Kali Yuga, because they can't understand Upanishads and Vedas. So Vedavyasa wrote Puranas to explain things more clearly, and Bhagavad Gita, of course, Mahabharata. So again, the Pancharatra is there to explain how to worship the Lord in Kali Yuga. Particularly, Pancharatra has to do with deity worship. And therefore, usually the mantras are connected with the main mantras that we get through Diksha are connected with deity worship. So Jiva Goswami says in the Bhakti Sandarva that, yes, of course we can just chant Hare Krishna, and we don't need initiation for that. But if we're going to do Archana, deity worship, then we need Pancharatrik Diksha. So that is one of the purposes of the Pancharatrik Diksha, to do the deity worship. And of course, Rupa Goswami says that, yes, holy name is prominent, it's the Yuga Dharma, but we have chanting the holy name, hearing the Bhagavatam, worshipping the deity, living in the holy Dhamma, associating with the devotees as the primary angas of bhakti. So if you want to worship the deity, we have to use the Pancharatrika standards. Therefore, we have to get a diksha. For that reason, the diksha is there. So it is useful for worshipping the deity, whereas the Vedic mantras are useful for fire sacrifice. So therefore, the deity worship, even though it is a Dwarpa Yuga, Yuga Dharma, for one who gets Pancharatrik Diksha, then he can also do the deity worship in Kali Yuga. However, as I said, the holy name takes predominance in Kali Yuga. So that is the Yuga Dharma, not the deity worship. So along with the chanting, along with the worship of the deity, deity worship in Kali Yuga, we must always have chanting of the holy name. So we can never forget to chant Hare Krishna. That always has to be there. But that does not mean that therefore we reject deity worship or all the other forms. No, we also do them. We can do them. And advisable to do these, at least these five angas of bhakti. So for the deity worship, generally one needs the Pancharatrik mantras to get the Pancharatrik mantras, and one needs the Pancharatrik diksha. So therefore, we have what is called diksha in our sampradaya for that reason. So in this way, we get the advantage of whatever the Vedic mantras give, but it's in a more liberal form, because you don't have to have the birth, etc., and you only have to have faith. Still, one needs some qualification. One has to be a true Vaishnava, and after one is under, attains that qualification, then the guru gives the Vaishnava mantras to you. And then one can, this establishes one's relationship to the deity, the mantra. It's non-different from the deity, and it establishes a relationship with the deity. So that is the Pancharatrik system. So for us, that is equivalent to the third birth. Now, do we need the second birth at all? No. So ultimately, only we need the Vaishnava Diksha. That's all we need, ultimately. Of course, we have to take the first birth. We have to be born first. But after we grow up a little bit, then we can take the Vaishnava birth. And that is sufficient, in one sense. So then why do we also get the other Gayatri? sometimes people get it anyway, as Lord Chaitanya did when he was a child, that he was a Brahmin. So when he was a child, he got his thread and took his Vedic mantra. And then later on, he got his Vaishnava Diksha. So that process may be there. One may get it as a child anyway, and then one becomes a Vaishnava. So one has, let's say, three births there also. But if one is not a Vaishya Kshatriya or a Brahmin, then one wouldn't get a thread. If one was a Sudra or a Chandala or a Mlecha or anything, one could simply survive on the Vaishnava Diksha, and there's no problem with that, in theory. Now, practically, in terms of India, there is a problem. In the West, there wouldn't be a problem, but in India, there is a problem. Because then we see the Vaishnavas, the Vaishnavas worshipping the deity and doing all sorts of things. And then the Brahmins look at you and say, you are not, you're not qualified. You're a Mlecha, you're a Sudra. You can't worship the deity. Where's your thread? You're not a higher caste. So that prejudice is still there, that even if you are a Vaishnav, if you don't have a thread, and you don't have a twice born also, then you're considered a low class. So this is one, social problem, we can say this, with simply being a Vaishnava. You get criticized by other people as being low class. It's not only in ancient times. It came up even into the late 19th, 20th century. The criticism was still there. Who is superior, Vaishnava or Brahmin? And they had a debate on this in Midnapur. And Bhakti Vinod Thakur was called to support the Vaishnava point of view. Others were the smartas, let's say. The Brahmins were saying, no, the Vaishnava who is not a Brahmin, he should not worship the Shalagram Shila. So they had a debate on this issue there in Midnapur. Is the Gaudiya Vaishnava qualified to worship the Shalagram Shila if he's not also a Brahmana? So they called various persons from Vrindavan, Babaji's, etc., and Bengal also, and the Smartas were also there. And they all gave their little speeches and things like that. And Bhakti Vinod Thakur was not feeling well, so he sent Bhakti Siddhanta Thakur there to argue on his behalf. So Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, of course, as we know, was very, very knowledgeable of all scriptures. And if you look in the Mahabharata, then you'll see how the idea of Brahminical caste is condemned, that simply you are elevated by the nature of your birth as a Brahmana. That gets condemned. And if you have the qualities and you're not a Brahmana by birth, still you should be considered Brahminical, etc. So he had all these quotations ready, and he quoted all this. First he praised the Brahmana, said Brahmana is very nice, he's worshipable, all society has all good qualities, etc. All the Brahmanas are very happy with that. And then he said, what the actual qualifications are, and if you don't have them, then you're not a Brahmin. He said that also, and they became a little upset by that. And then he said, the next point was that one who is a Vaishnava automatically transcends all gunas. So he is superior to the Brahmin, because the Brahmin is only sattva-gun. So the Vaishnava is transcendental to the gunas. So whatever good qualities anybody has are included within the Vaishnava. So therefore, automatically, if you think you're good as a Brahmana, the Vaishnava already has those qualities. So he's automatically a Brahmin, whatever you think a Brahmin should be. The Vaishnava is already that also. So that was an argument. And, of course, the crowd, the listeners, they were supporting this also. So based on that, he introduced the second Jamma into our initiation. So we have our Vaishnava initiation. We of course we're born, and then we grow up, and then we have faith and association, and then we get Vaishnava initiation. And because we are Vaishnavas, then we also get the Vedic, the second birth. So we get both at that time. And with the Vaishnava Diksha, then we get the Vedic Diksha also, that is the second birth. So for that reason we get this thread, etc. Though it is not directly related to the Vaishnava Vidhi. and not important in one sense. He did that to show that the Vaishnava is qualified for whatever everybody else in society and Brahmins are qualified for. And the Vaishnava includes everything else. So therefore, he gave this thread, etc. That's the importance. So it is at that time, it was a social consideration that, okay, the Vaishnava is whatever good qualities you think you have as a Brahmin, the Vaishnava also has, because he surpasses them. So that was his strategy in combining in our so-called second initiation. We have two dikshas there, actually, third and second diksha. So that is the what Bhakti Sandhya Saraswati Thakur did. So that is the, we can say, also the origin of our diksha procedure, how we do it. So with the Vaishnava diksha, that is superior actually to the Brahminical diksha, because as Lord Chaitanya explains in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, you know, out of millions of people, then, you know, one is civilized and talks to Varnashram, and out of the Varnashram, a few of them actually follow properly. And out of those few that follow properly, some are actually Brahminical and Sattvic, and out of those two Sattvic people, maybe a few are Vaishnavas. So the Vaishnava there is considered superior to the Brahman and to the Varnashram, etc. So that same conclusion is there also. So anyway, that is just a commentary on the third birth. So the Brahmanas here understood that all of their qualifications, including their three births and their learning and their high level of family background and their expertise in doing the rituals of sacrifice, were actually useless if they were not connected with the Supreme Lord. So this is mentioned, of course, in the Bhagavatam and other places, that whatever is there, whether it is karma, kanda, or jnana yoga, or astanga yoga, it is useless unless there's a connection with the Supreme Lord. And if you do not worship the Supreme Lord without offense in those processes, you will get zero effect. So if you condemn Vishnu and you do all the devata worship, you're not going to get the results you think you're going to get from the devatas. If you want to worship the devatas, you also have to worship Vishnu. Then, of course, we have the Panchopasana there and the Smarta Vidhi, where they worship Vishnu plus Ganesh and Durga Devi and Shiva, etc. They worship everybody, but they also worship Vishnu there. And therefore, we'll see also in the Mayavadi worship, even though ultimately they give up worship, still they will include Vishnu among all the persons they worship. And we'll see with yoga. In yoga, they have to do upasana. Also, they have to do worship also there. And who is the worship? Worship is Vishnu again. So in all of these other processes, one has to accept the Supreme Lord Vishnu and worship him also. So then we'll say, well, it's all bhakti. Varnashram karma yoga is bhakti. Gyan yoga is bhakti. Everything is bhakti. Yeah, it is in one sense. But the bhakti is little, minor. And the other things are made majority. So therefore, we don't call it bhakti. We can call bhakti Mr. Karma or bhakti Mr. Gyan or bhakti Mr. Yoga like that. But it is a little bit only. But it must be there to get those effects. So if you want material results, you also have to worship Vishnu. If you want to get liberation, you also have to worship Vishnu. And if you don't, you won't get liberation. Yeah, so that's why there's a verse in the Bhagavatam, you know, that the, what is it, vimukta manina. One thinks one is liberated, but again they fall down. Why? Because they offend the Lord. They don't accept the lotus feet of the Lord and worship him. They think they're Gyanis, and they think they're going to get liberation, but they don't, because they don't accept the Supreme Lord. And if you're a Gyani who accepts the Supreme Lord, then the Lord gives liberation. He will give it to you. So therefore, even the Gyani who wants to get liberated into the impersonal aspect, even he has to worship the Supreme Lord without offense. Even a little bit. And that little bit of bhakti stays with him when he renounces Jnana and everything, which is sattvic, when he gets liberation, and the bhakti remains. And that gives him liberation. So, However, as I said, these are not encouraged in one sense. That's why Krishna ultimately rejects karma yoga and jnana yoga and astanga yoga, because the bhakti is very little. It's there, but it's nominal, we can say. And they have other desires there, for liberation or enjoyment. So therefore, it is better if the bhakti is in majority. And then it is better. And if it's pure bhakti, that's the best. So therefore we get karma mr. bhakti and gyan mr. bhakti and yoga mr. bhakti mentioned in Bhagavad Gita. And then we get pure bhakti. So all of those are better than karma with a little bhakti, or jnana with a little bhakti, or yoga with a little bhakti. Karma mr. bhakti is better. It is bhakti with a little karma, or bhakti with a little jnana, bhakti with a little yoga. That's better. But better than that is pure bhakti. No mixture of the other processes at all. Only the processes of bhakti. That is considered the best. And no other desires. So that is why Rupa Goswami has therefore very emphatically given a very precise definition of bhakti at the beginning of Nectar Devotion. Ani abhilashita shunya, jnana karma jnanavartakam. No other desire. And Krishna Nusilanam, no other worship except Krishna or the Vishnu forms. And it has to be favorable to the Lord. So he gives a very precise definition of what is pure bhakti. And is that pure bhakti which will give you the highest realization, which is what Lord Chaitanya is teaching us. That is, we get a direct relationship with the Supreme Lord. If we have karma misra bhakti and jnana misra bhakti, we don't even get that. We get the Lord in one sense, because we go to the spiritual world, but we don't have a relationship, much of a relationship. At most, shanta relationship. As if we have jnana misra bhakti or yoga misra bhakti, we get shanta rasa. But this is considered a lesser rasa, inferior rasa. So if one wants higher rasas, then one has to do that pure bhakti without any other desires except to try to please the Lord and satisfy Him at all times. And that is what is emphasized here in the Bhagavatam. So the wives of the Brahmanas, what do they have? Pure bhakti. They didn't care about the karma aspect of the sacrifices and all that. They saw Krishna. Only we have to serve Krishna. Yet Krishna says, give something, we'll give something to Him. Finished. And that is a pure bhakti. No other motives involved. And the husbands, they were stuck in karma. We have to do the sacrifices and we can't give anything to Krishna because we have to finish our sacrifice. And doing so, they missed the whole point of sacrifice. The whole point of sacrifice has to include worship of the Lord also, even if it's minor. And they cut out Krishna completely from it. Even the Supreme Lord appears directly before them and said, no, we cannot give anything to Him. So they made a big mistake. Whereas their wives had natural attraction for Krishna. And this made them much superior. So the husbands realize this, that we are useless. And all this karma also is useless, because without the Supreme Lord it is useless. And even if we do the karma with the Supreme Lord, Krishna is more attractive anyway than all of this. And that's what the wives understood. So we don't have to do all this also. It's secondary. It's only a means to get to Krishna. That's all. So therefore it's all rejectable, all of these things. The brahminical births, the rituals they do, the learning they have, their birth, all useless ultimately. Because it is only one step, and a material step at that, to get to the stage of devotion to the Lord. So finally they realize that. Okay.
So that in that time they were not realized that Krishna is the Supreme Person.
Yeah.
And afterwards when wives gave food to Krishna, and after that episode they come to the realization that Krishna is the Supreme Person and devotion to them is the topmost. So how that realization occurred all of a sudden?
Well, one is association, the good example of their wives, and then the second is the mercy of Krishna.
So because of the devotion of their wives, they got that realization?
Association. And that mentions in the previous verse of good association. But then ultimately mercy of Krishna is there also. He made, in other words, he said, I will arrange, he told the wives, I will make arrangements so when you go back to your husbands, they will in no way criticize you. And they will be very peaceful. So Krishna exerted his mercy upon them, so they softened their heart. He softened their hearts, actually.
According to, as Krishna explained in the Bhagavad Gita, that according to quality, guna and karma, that
guna karma vibhaga.
Sometimes in Vedic tradition, we see examples like Karna and Vidura may
birth.
So how can we explain?
Oh yeah, yes. Brahman is not only determined by birth. In the previous yugas, the birth was emphasized because by, let's say, predominance of examples. So generally, if a person was born in a higher family, he would have higher qualities. Why? Because they didn't intermarry, and the varnashram system was intact, so they trained their children properly. Yeah? So we can say it's genetics or whatever like that, but generally the system was stable. And the population prediction was stable on Brahmin families having Brahmin qualities, etc. Or Kshatriya having Kshatriya qualities, etc. So they had stable family units and stable society and no intermixing of castes, etc. And that went on. In any case, the birth is one qualification. Your parents, obviously. Another is tapas, your sense of austerity or sense control. Another is vidya, knowledge that you get. Yeah? So when you are a certain age, that's mature, then if you have all three, good, then you become brahminical or whatever, and do your, or kshatriya or whatever, according to the level of knowledge, tapas, etc. Then you put into the caste system. Eh? In Kali Yuga, the birth becomes less of a factor, and the tapas and vidya become more important. Why? Because varnashram system not intact, intermarriage is there, all problems are there, and people don't get the proper education or whatever. So we have to look at a person very carefully in Kali Yuga. And therefore it says everyone is born as sudra basically, and then we'll see when he grows up what actual qualities he has, what sense control he has, education he has when he's mature. And then we'll see, then we'll classify him at that time only, not just by birth. So therefore in Kali Yuga the other factors become more prominent. Before it was more or less automatic that they would develop properly with those qualities also, but in Kali Yuga, no. It may be you have the birth, but we'll have to look at your qualities when you're mature. That is your sense control and your knowledge. So they become more prominent in Kali Yuga, those factors, and the Janma, a lesser factor.
You just mentioned you have not mixing of castes.
Yeah.
But in the Bhagavatam it mentions Pratiloma and Anuloma. What period are you talking about? I mean, there was mixing of mixed
castes. Well, yeah, the improper way. They shouldn't at least do the improper way. Anuloma was permitted and Pratiloma was not. Where the woman marries down, that was not permitted. Where the man marries down, it was permitted.
So that's included as not mixing of castes.
Yeah. And we say, even in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about this in the first chapter, you know, if I do the war and the women are left and there's no men, then the caste, you know, intermarriage, the caste will take place and then the whole system will get upset, the women become degraded, and then the whole, we have Varna Shankara, unwanted population, mixed castes, and then, you know, society falls apart and there's no traditions left. Which means, basically, the family units become broken and they don't know what they're supposed to do. I mean, no one knows what they're supposed to do in the society because you got the women and the men, all different castes, you know, and their families all mixed up also. So they don't know what to do anymore. They're confused. And of course, then the children end up unproductive in society because of confusion.
Maharaj, in Gayatri Mantra, Om Bhurva Swaha, is it worship of sun or Lord Vishnu?
Well, according to Agni Purana and Jiva Goswami, it is Vishnu. The Savita means, of course, Savitra means the sun, often the sun god is there represented. But it also means one who inspires or impels. Huh? So one who pushes everything, the instigator of everything. So that can be Vishnu also. Of course, Madhvacharya he wrote a little commentary on the first verses of the, I think, Rig Veda. And there he says that all names are named in the Vedas are names of Vishnu. And secondarily the names of Devas, like Indra, etc. So primarily Indra means Vishnu. Secondarily it means Indra, the demigod. Because the main qualities, all the qualities the Devatas have, actually first reside in God himself, and secondarily in Jivas, such as Devatas. They reflect those qualities. So he gives an example like Agni. Agni is a Devata of fire. But what does Agni mean? It comes from the root Ni. And Ni means to lead. So the leader is Agni. So Vishnu is the real leader. Agni is a secondary leader. Like this. So he analyzes the names of the Devatas in terms of Vishnu. And ultimately Vishnu is the one with all the qualities. And all the names apply to him first and secondarily to the Devatas.
Bhagavad Gita explains different divisions of faith. Such a thing as like transcendental faith, I think you were saying.
Oh, yeah. The three types of faith are mentioned, sattva, raja, tama, in the Bhagavad Gita. And that sattvic faith is considered, and of course anything in sattva is better than in tama and raja, that's the ultimate purport of all that. But still it is guna. So transcendental to that, of course, is devotion to the Lord. And of course Krishna says, you know, bhakti is transcendental to the gunas. Saguna samati chaitan, it is transcendental to the gunas. And Vishnu Jagavati comments there, even sadhana bhakti, even though you do have, you know, impurities, that also is transcendental to the gunas, because bhakti can never be, you know, part of the gunas. It may be covered, as in, you know, the holy name, etc., because we do have impurities, but nevertheless, the bhakti itself is transcendental. So it's beyond the gunas, and that faith also is beyond the gunas. So when we have shraddha as a qualification for bhakti, that is not, does not come from sattva guna. It is not by doing sattvic activities that one will develop faith for Vishnu. No. Where does it come from? Association of other devotees with faith. And where does that come from? Ultimately, Supreme Lord. His Shakti is there. So it is that faith is transcendental. Well, of course, I think the smartest will say it is Ganesh. I believe the Madhvas take it as Hayagriva. I think so. I'm not sure, but I think they take it as Hayagriva. Sri Sampradaya, I don't know how they take it. Oh, probably, if anything, and they take it as Ganesh, they'll take it as Vishrakshena then, because Ganesh and Vishrakshena look exactly alike, except Vishrakshena is the elephant in the spiritual world, and Ganesh is the one in Swargaloka or wherever. So Vishrakshena is like Ganesh, he's an elephant-headed personality, and he's the head of the army in Vaikuntha. But can refer to Vishnu also, I suppose, according to Madhvacharya, and maybe that's why they take it as Hayagriva. Okay. There's two things going on. One is we get the holy name, and then we advance through that. And we get the holy name. Along with the holy name, we should get teachings, at least. We get knowledge, Bhagavad Gyana, along with that. Otherwise, we'll have Nalavas. So therefore, we at least need Shiksha Guru for that. And then we can go through the process. We have faith. Then we seek out association. We get a guru who gives us holy name and teachings of the holy name. And then we can do Bhajana Kriya and go up that way. So that's how it can be done. So at least you need a Shiksha Guru. But then, of course, Rupa Goswami says that generally we should also try to do deity worship, and that way we can, when we chant Krishna's name, then we also understand who is Krishna with his form. So therefore, for that we need the mantra and the diksha, so to speak, the mantra diksha, mantrasha diksha. And so theoretically, there is independent, and just the holy name plus the Chiksha Guru, at least you would need. But then, if we're going to do deity worship, that means the Diksha Guru also. And generally, he says you should. And also another reason, he says, generally people cannot simply chant the holy name; their senses are restless, so they should engage their senses by doing deity worship, all their senses. So this is a good way of doing it. So he recommends in most cases they should also do deity worship. Therefore, they should also take Diksha and have Diksha Guru. Is that their eternal position? Sometimes they can change by the mercy of the Lord, Shanta, especially if they're Shanta Bhaktas now. So examples, some examples are given. I think Bilva Mongkol Thakur is an example of that. He was an impersonalist, then he became a Shanta Bhakta, and then he got Madhurya Rasa or something like that by the mercy of devotees and Krishna. Another is Sukadev. He was in Shanta Rasa also, kind of liberated person, Atma Rama, and then Shanta Rasa, and then he also got Madhurya Rasa. So they can progress in that case, in those cases from Shanta Rasa. Whether it's in the spiritual world, I think usually the cases are in the material world when that happens, before they go to the spiritual world.
So in the material world, they become aware of their eternal position, that they are in Shanta Rasa, or how do they realize that they have relationship with the Lord within Shanta
Rasa? They get Shanta Rasa because they have great attachment to Jnana and peace. everything is peaceful. That's their goal, you know. And they're practicing Jnana. By the mercy of devotees, and they change over to bhakti, and therefore they get rasa, but that influence of jnana remains, so it's called jnana mistra bhakti because of that. They can, of course, renounce the jnana completely and become pure bhaktas, and then, of course, they can go beyond shanta. But if they hold on to this type of influence of jnana a little bit, and then that the idea is they like to see the Lord, but they don't so much hear about the Lord in his pastimes and relish the, you know, service. Eh? Because I think maybe that's too disturbing. Let us just be peaceful. So therefore they get Shanta Rasa from that. In the womb he already had. He didn't want to come out of the womb because he said, this material world is a big disturbance, so why should I come out? And then I think the Lord promised him, well, you can come out, and I'll guarantee you'll not be disturbed by anything in this material world. So he already had Shanta Rasa from, I guess, previous birth or whatever.
Maharaj, you explained that the objective of the Gayatri Mantra is to qualify us to perform deity worship.
Vaishnava Gayatris. And other mantras.
How exactly is Vaishnava Gayatri Mantra related to deity worship?
Not just the Gayatri mantras, but the other mantras also. Gayatri is particularly a 24 syllable mantra, and then there's other mantras also. The other mantras are useful because they are direct representations of those particular deities, like Krishna and Gauranga, etc. And in Pancharatrik worship, the medium of connection with the deity is through mantra. So we have deity and we're here, but then, you know, we are impure. We've got material bodies, so we have to purify ourselves. And there's various rituals in the archana to purify the body and the mind and all the elements like that, so that we can actually approach and touch the deity. And we've got impure bodies. So to help in that relationship with the deity, and purify us, then we have the Vaishnava mantras for that particular deity. So we have a Krishna mantra to relate us to the Krishna deity, and a Lord Chaitanya mantra for Lord Chaitanya.
You said the word Hari Rava
was chanting the elements in Bhakti. No. Some people will take that. There's a particular mantra they chant along with the Gayatri mantras. And the Sri Sampradaya take it as Hayagriva, and the Shris, I said, probably will take it as the Vishaksena, who's the head of the army in Vaikuntha, because he's also an elephant. He's also an elephant, and he looks like Ganesh. But the smartest take it as a Ganesh mantra. That's all. Okay. Hare Krishna.
Yeah.